the level of wages being earned in relationship to what's needed to have the very basic family budget it doesn't look very good in this state.
A gloomy outlook for Alaska's middle class. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 9th of September. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the state public employee unions prepare to negotiate new contracts.
The state is not effectively recruiting new, younger people into their ranks.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. THREAD helps families make good choices about early care and education for their children. Formerly known as Child Care Connection, THREAD connects families throughout Alaska with quality child care, family child care programs, licensed centers, preschool or Head Start programs at no cost. THREAD offers parenting workshops, resources, and help with parenting issues. Find out more online at threadalaska.org. This message sponsored by THREAD, connecting early care and education to Alaska.
The state epidemiologist says the 10-year-old Fairbanks boy who had swine flu and died quickly last Friday likely was overwhelmed by a secondary bacterial infection. Beth Funk says the medical examiner took tissue samples during the boy's autopsy and cultured them. She says the lung tissue showed a heavy bacterial infection. Dick Mansager, head of the Providence, Alaska Medical Center where the boy died, described the case as highly unusual. He says parents need to be reminded that most children who develop H1N1 flu get mild cases and recover uneventfully. A new report analyzing the status of working families in Alaska has been released by the Alaska Center for Public Policy, a local think tank. The research looks at how middle and low-income families are faring in a stagnant economy and finds they're in trouble. Lawrence Weiss is the director of the center. He says they wanted to know what it takes for a family to hang on to even the lower rungs of middle-class life. He says the picture is bleak, and for a family of four in Anchorage, it takes about $53,000 a year for just a bare-bones budget.
We're not talking renter's insurance, we're not talking vacations or any saved money, just, you know, the bare necessities that, you know, that you might consider the middle class.
Weiss says this covers only housing, food, child care, transportation, and health care. He says a lot of attention is placed on people who are at or 50% above the poverty level.
But the problem is that there's tens of thousands of Alaskan families who are between poverty level and a very basic family budget.
Weiss says Alaska has poor consumer regulatory protections to keep health insurance premiums reasonable and affordable. He says more state support for community health centers and increased access to Denali Kid Care is needed.
Other states, it's easier for low-income children to get in, and proportionally more of them can get in other states than in our state. And that's strictly something in control of the state, in control by our legislature, and they've been really remiss on providing children with the health care access that they need.
He cites a family he spoke to that is paying $400 a month for health insurance premiums on a policy that requires a $15,000 yearly deductible. He likens these types of insurance policies to unethical subprime mortgages.
They're really being sold on grounds that I think are often as good as fraudulent, because the brokers know that these people can't really, when a serious illness kicks in, these people won't be able to see the first insurance dollar because the deductibles are so high. Those families are going to go bankrupt before they can ever even reach those. And that's more and more what the national research is showing. So to me, that's one of the biggest problems that we're facing.
Weiss says the perception that wages are higher in Alaska doesn't stand up to the reality of what those wages will buy here. He says Alaska wages have been stagnant since 2002 and family incomes since 2000. He says comparing Alaska wages to other states shows we're falling behind.
The fact is that we're not doing very well in that regard. We're not doing very well in terms of wages because the trends are wrong, and the level of wages being earned in relationship to what's needed to have the very basic family budget doesn't look very good in this state.
Weiss says those earning the minimum wage in Alaska of $7.25 an hour are near poverty and live at constant risk. He says in order for a two-parent, two-child household to meet a basic budget, an individual would need to earn 3.5 times that wage. A single-parent, single-child household would need 2.5 times the minimum wage to survive. Weiss says economic indicators show Alaska is heading into a recession. And he says the state is ranked one of the lowest in terms of weekly benefits for unemployment compensation. He says one of the main points of the study is to show Alaska lawmakers how many families are well below middle class and barely above poverty.
It's that whole netherworld that legislators don't really think about. Maybe they don't really believe they exist. I'm not really sure. But we wanted to provide some very clear numbers and standards, so that if a legislator says, well, we're already funding some kind of relief at above poverty, so we've done our job, we're done. I think our study indicates, no, they're not done, that there's a lot more work to do, that there's a lot more families in jeopardy.
The report is available online. Links are at our website, aprn.org. Four public employee unions are gearing up for contract negotiations next month with the Parnell administration. Most contracts expire at the end of the fiscal year on June 30th, but one has already expired and members have turned down a tentative agreement. Amy Bracken reports.
This Labor Day was an unusual one for the 1,800 state workers represented by Labor, Trades, and Crafts. In the past, members of the bargaining unit could enjoy burgers and dogs on their Monday holiday with the assurance that they had a fresh contract in place. Not so this fall. That's because members rejected the state's offer of a 1.5% wage increase. Labor, Trades, and Crafts Local 71 business manager Tom Bryce was taking pictures at Monday's Central Labor Council's picnic in Juneau. He says the proposed contract was unacceptable considering recent pay raises given to state commissioners.
When you have commissioners and directors getting 5%, 10% pay raises in these times, the people that are out there taking care of the Pioneer's home and keeping our roads safe for Alaskans should see something substantial as well. Maybe not 5 or 10%, but something more than 1.5.
Local 71 talks with the state are set to begin October 6th. Meanwhile, three other public employee unions representing more than 10,000 members also are getting ready for talks this fall. Tiara Hoff is an executive board member for the Association of Confidential Employees, who work on personnel matters. She describes herself as almost 30 and says she's seeing state employees her age driven away by low wages and an unpopular retirement plan.
I think we are already losing a number of employees because of those factors. I think that over the next 5 years, with all the people that we have retiring out of Tier 1 and Tier 2, that we're going to see a huge decrease in employment with the state and that we need to beef up wages and keep people here.
More seasoned union members say this turnover among newer employees affects them too. Pete Ford is the Southeast Regional Director for the Alaska Public Employees Association, which represents state supervisors and confidential employees. He says vacancies at the bottom mean a burden at the top.
The state is not effectively recruiting new, younger people into their ranks. They have a fairly veteran cadre of employees who are typically doing 2 and 3 jobs. Because jobs are vacant, they can't get jobs filled, and they're just literally doing heroic work to keep this business of the state going.
In negotiations, Ford and other labor leaders hope the state will take into account higher costs of living in certain areas, like Juneau, a consideration they call geographic differential, or geodiff.
Juneau has been hurting for geodiff recognition for a very long time. The cost of living is demonstrably, measurably more significant here than elsewhere, and yet the people here don't get a geodiff addition.
A geographic differential study released by the state in May shows the cost of living in Juneau to be 11% higher than that of Anchorage. This was the first such study to be conducted by the state in 24 years. Just how attentive the Parnell administration will be to such considerations is an unknown that labor leaders are approaching with cautious optimism. Some hope to be heard more than they were in recent years, in spite of Governor Parnell's recent promises of a conservative approach to spending. Jim Duncan is business manager for the Alaska State Employees Association.
I can understand belt tightening. I mean, that needs to be done in any government. But you also need to pay your workers and pay them well and attract and retain workers into state government.
Duncan served with Parnell in the state legislature. He says he believes the new governor understands the need for pay raises, but his approach to contract talks is hard to predict. Parnell's Department of Administration Commissioner, Annette Kreitzer, declined to comment on the upcoming negotiations. In Juneau, I'm Amy Bracken.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an unusual trip down the Yukon River.
We wanted to come there, not flying in, but on the ground level.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, and by GrantStation, your fast track to funding, on the web at grantstation.com, serving Alaskan organizations for over 10 years.
American Recovery and Reinvestment Act funds will be used to help clean up underground storage tank leaks in Alaska. $200 million from the Leaking Underground Storage Tank Trust Fund has been allocated to the Environmental Protection Agency, which plans to divvy it up among all the states. APRN's Ellen Lockyer has more.
Alaska's share is $999,000 of the $8.4 million earmarked for EPA Region 10 states. The money will be spent on assessment and cleanup work at selected sites, according to Bill Janes, who is a project officer for the state's share of the recovery funds. He says the money is to be used according to federal and state specifications regarding underground storage tank requirements.
These projects are expensive. $1 million or a little less than $1 million does not go very far. So what we did was we went through our database and looked for sites to meet a few criteria. Number one, we looked for kind of what are called orphan sites. That is, the system is not necessarily in operation any longer. The current landowner didn't cause the problem, but the current landowner would sure like to have it cleaned up. And we looked for sort of some of our higher risk sites, especially where groundwater is contaminated and there might be nearby drinking water wells.
Janes says the state has worked hard to reduce the number of open leaking underground storage tanks over the past 10 years. He says now there are about 480 such tanks identified in a state database, and 15 of those have been selected as candidates for recovery fund work.
Most of these were discovered during the early 1990s when the old tank systems were pulled out and upgraded to meet new federal storage tank requirements. That's when all this contamination was discovered. You know, anywhere there's a road, anywhere there's a filling station or some other regulated tank, most of them are associated with gas stations, but there's others too.
Initial proposals have been issued for work on underground tanks in Tokë, Fairbanks, and Healy for a start. Janes says bids are coming in for review, and work is slated to begin in early October. He says further work depends on how much funding is available after the three projects are underway. The initial work could provide some related jobs, too.
This money will help firms such as consulting companies retain employees and scientists that, you know, may not have made it through this difficult time. It will employ perhaps, backhoe operators and that type of thing that may be doing excavations at these sites to get out dirty soil, that type of thing.
Jane says all three sites could have contaminated groundwater stemming from the underground leaks, and the cleanup projects will provide more information on risks to human health and the need for the installation of groundwater monitoring wells at the sites. For APRN, I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Fishermen in western Alaska, suffering from bad runs and limited availability to king and chum salmon this year, finally got a chance to make some money for their winter needs. But it wasn't much. John Hilsinger, the director of commercial fisheries for the Department of Fish and Game, says during a six-hour coho opening in the Yukon Delta on Sunday, 48 boats caught only 400 coho and 100 fall chum. He says the short opening was to determine what the harvest of both species would be.
We are likely somewhat below the low end of the escapement goal range on fall chums. And so we've timed these openings after the vast majority of the fall chums have gone through the District Y1 where the opening was. And so we wanted to be sure still, though, that we did not have a real large fall chum catch.
He says the harvest results were about what biologists expected for such a short opening. An opening yesterday was much better, though, when 30 boats took part in a 9-hour opening. Hilsinger says they brought in 1,273 coho and 680 chum. He says the coho numbers were at the high end of predictions, but the chum were much higher than expected.
We are still concerned about the fall chum escapements, and so we were trying to get this in at a time when most of the fall chum run was passed, and we would have relatively low fall chum catches.
Hilsinger says there are no openings today and tomorrow, but other openings will likely take place possibly as soon as Friday. They will be determined on a day-to-day basis. The current shortages are the result of an unexplained weak return of chum. He says the total return this year has been about 300,000 fish, but the system needs at least that just for spawning. Subsistence harvests have taken the return below the minimum. He expects the coho run will be average or above average, lasting the rest of the month. Whether fishermen will take advantage of the later openings will depend on the availability of the fish processor, the cost of boat operations, and catch rates of later openings. Southeast business and government leaders will meet in Haines mid-month to talk about energy, transportation, economic development, and other regional issues. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld has this preview of the annual meeting of the Southeast Conference.
Mayors, legislators, business owners, and municipal staff from around the region will meet in a Haines School gymnasium September 15th to 17th. It's an annual get-together where Southeast movers, shakers, and observers talk about problems and search for solutions. Energy is a major theme for this year's Southeast Conference annual meeting. That includes a joint hearing of three legislative committees dealing with the issue. Senate Energy Committee member Bert Stedman of Sitka says it's one in a series of statewide meetings to gather information.
The legislature is getting around to all corners of the state, getting input from the people on what they feel are challenges in the energy arena, you know, in their area of the state. And the state is so vast that, you know, Southeast is substantially different from, you know, Northern Alaska or Western Alaska or the Rail Belt. So you can't have one-part solution that fixes everything for everybody.
The Senate Resources and House Energy Committees will also be represented. The Southeast Conference annual meeting will also take up new developments in Canada's railroad system. Conference Executive Director Shelley Wright says it follows up on last year's annual gathering in Prince Rupert. That included discussion of the British Columbia City's rail-connected container port.
Canada has really started putting a push on developing their northern end and including Southeast Alaska in their shipping plans. So that's kind of exciting. That's new, and it's just happened since we were in Prince Rupert.
Conference members will also check in on plans for a regional landfill. Wright says the group has developed an ordinance communities need to approve to form a regional solid waste authority.
Wrangell, Craig, and Petersburg have all voted to put the authority on their ballot for the October election. So they will be voting whether to accept the ordinances as an authority, and hopefully that will begin the authority, and then we can hand the gauntlet over to those communities and they can take it from there.
Health, mining, logging, and other Southeast issues will also be on the agenda. Speakers include Native leader Willie Hensley, Alaska Airlines Vice President Bill McKay, and Education Commissioner Larry Ledoux. And Governor Sean Parnell will address the conference, something his predecessor skipped. In Juneau, this is Ed Schoenfeld.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Pin Air, with 50 years of flying experience and offering charter service throughout Alaska and the United States. Details online at pinair.com. And by Alaska Communication Systems. ACS offers high-capacity, high-speed bandwidth for business with speeds up to Gig E, connecting companies from the North Slope to Ketchikan to each other and the rest of the world.
The East Coast will get a new look at Alaska's economy and future in energy markets later this month when the Alaska House, a New York City nonprofit, holds one of its monthly presentations on state issues. The year-old Alaska House has hosted previous events on state's tourism, arts, and fishing industry. Executive Director Tracy Foster says the upcoming presentation will likely be attended by the New York City media as well as business leaders interested in energy and economics.
We've invited a panel of experts or leaders from different sectors to talk a little bit about, what's next for Alaska. You know, we've had a change in administration that's happened, and obviously we're still dealing with a recession. So I think, you know, there is an appetite here in New York for some new news, and that's basically what this panel is designed to do.
Leading the discussion will be David Rubenstein, co-founder and managing director of the Carlyle Group, one of the largest investment firms in the world. Also taking part will be University of Alaska Anchorage Chancellor Fran Ulmer, State Senate President Gary Stevens, and Margie Brown, CEO of Cook Inlet Regional Corporation. Foster says part of the panel's focus will be on Alaska's role as an energy provider for the nation, but it will also take time to look at alternative and renewable energy development.
I think that, you know, there is a lot of potential for Alaska to lead on that front. And I do think, the rest of the country is looking to see if that will happen. So I'm hoping that the panelists will touch on that. I certainly know that the Q&A and the audience will be interested in hearing about that.
The panel discussion will take place September 24th at 2:30 Alaska time, and they're working on having a live audio or video conference feed. State Representative Sharon Cisna had never been on a river trip, but that didn't stop her and her husband, Sid Atwood, from embarking on a 4-week canoe adventure down the Tanana and Yukon Rivers this summer. The couple, both in their late 60s, wanted to visit communities along the way to see how residents weathered the long winter. They had also hoped to get a sense of what types of state programs would be most beneficial as rural residents cope with high energy prices, dwindling salmon runs, and limited access to health care. Cisna says arriving at each village on the river seemed like the ideal way to get a true sense of each community.
We wanted to come there, not flying in, not carrying all our nice stuff and arriving as the people from town, but on the ground level, trying to be sure that we were able to understand to the degree we could, even though we were just coming in for a short time, we wanted to be on an equal basis. And so we decided the canoe was it.
Pardon me, but it sounds like you were a bit of a greenhorn team going out here on the river.
Oh, very much so, yeah. And what neither of us had really expressed is how really terrified we were. And especially the closer we got, we were very busy all summer long, just racing around when we had any extra time at all, grabbing things that we were going to take on the trip. But we didn't have the time actually to figure much out. And so there we are putting the canoe in and kind of bickering with each other, which is not a style we've normally had. And that was true for the first few days. We were very much up against it. We were very much afraid of the river at that point and very much afraid of our own inability and lack of time we'd spend getting ready. But we did it.
And so things must have smoothed out to some degree. And what was the first community that you stopped to visit?
The town of Tanana was the first visit after we had gone down the Tanana 3 days. And we saw on those 3 days, at the very beginning, we saw people coming up from the spit looking at fish sites. But we went for 2 full days without seeing anyone. It was amazing. And you're on this huge, huge river.
But at the end of the Tanana, the confluence of the Tanana at the Yukon River is where we crossed. And that was an interesting crossing of the Yukon because we finally started about 3 or 3:30 in the morning, something like that, because we were in a bad spot and it would have been It had been too hot the day before, and then we were too cold in the middle of the night, so we had to get moving.
Yeah.
And we crossed the Yukon.
And then soon after that, we were able to start our interviews, and 2 days of actively talking to a huge percentage of the systems in the community and a lot of the individuals. So it was really a rich, rich, good introduction to the Yukon.
And the purpose of your trip was to gauge the needs of folks on the river systems. Is that primarily why you went?
They've got huge, all of these communities have huge things. The cost of fuel is just a fraction. So is the flooding, because you've also got, and a lot of it is governmental. Every single community talked about living by subsistence. And the Western entrance into their lives, which was a few hundred years ago, and it meant more and more and more regulations and rules by people who didn't live that lifestyle, coming in and changing the way they lived. And you could see it over and over, community by community, what had happened with money coming in, programs coming in, and how it shapes a community, oftentimes to the detriment. Nobody means that. They mean the best. But communities don't adequately get involved enough. People don't get involved enough to shape it so that they have a chance. The lifestyle that we witnessed was just not what it needs to be, not at the point we are in our civilization.
The picture that you've painted of the communities along the rivers that you visited sounds somewhat bleak, and I imagine that there were some good elements as well, but what do you think you'll take away from this experience and bring forward into the work of the legislature this coming session? And what do you think the winter looks like now for these folks?
Well, this winter is going to be tougher than last. And we won't have a legislative session until after the barges, which are not getting filled up according to the barge company we talked to. They're not getting the orders for fuel that they normally by now would be totally ready to deliver. And so they were, when we talked to them a week and a half ago, they were waiting for orders because they actually have empty barges right now. They may not make the kinds of trips they were planning on making. So that's one of the reasons why in January we've got our work cut out for us.
Democrat Sharon Cisna is a state representative from Anchorage. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Amy Bracken and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau and Ellen Lockyer from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The U.S. Bankruptcy Court for the District of Oregon has set a deadline for filing claims for anyone who has suffered injury by sexual, mental, or physical abuse or misconduct by a Jesuit priest or others, claiming the Society of Jesus Oregon Province has some responsibility. The deadline is November 30, 2009. Proof of claim forms are available online or by calling 1-888-909-0100. This message is sponsored by the Society of Jesus Oregon Province.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.